Welcome to Playable Character. I'm Shane Hinton. And this, the last episode of our first season, we thought it would be interesting to try something a little bit different, so Sean Ryder, Trevor Owens, and myself got together to discuss our thoughts on pieces from the first season and continue the conversation in some cases. We will be returning with all new episodes Thursday, October 6th, so make sure to stay tuned for that. In the meantime, we'll have some extra content available for you, but they won't be fully produced, edited episodes. So I hope you enjoy our roundtable discussion on Season 1. First up on the list is Trevor Dodge's piece from Episode 1 on Dante's Inferno.
Cantos that comprise Inferno are a lavish litany of revenge and serve to settle a host of scores with his personal enemy. A messy civil turf war in his hometown of Florence landed him in exile, and it was during that angry period late in his life that he began constructing his epic. Enemies for Dante, see, they have real names, they've committed real crimes, and in his estimation, they deserve real punishments. If you thought the Catholic League came unhinged over Kevin Smith's Dogma, just imagine its reaction to a video game wherein the player interactor willfully exacts corporal punishment upon a pope.
When I first read Trevor's piece on the First Wall Rebate blog section, shortly thereafter, Assassin's Creed 2 also came out, or I beat it sometime after reading this piece. And so on listening to Trevor's piece, I was actually really stricken by just, you know, that he mentions that, you know, killing the Pope is like the worst thing probably that you could illustrate in a game. But that's exactly how Assassin's Creed 2 ends, right? Is with you killing Rodrigo Borgia, who's Pope Alexander VI. So I really was curious about what does that say exactly? Is it that Ubisoft just has, you know, that much more gumption than Electronic Arts? But I think you can, you know, I think Assassin's Creed 2 proves that you can kill a pope in a video game, and that actually wasn't that big of a deal. You know, there's so much potential for sort of transgression in the historical context that, you know, Trevor Dodge's points are all still incredibly valid, but would definitely be interesting to see where, you know, something could go with a less sort of mainstream gaming approach.
It's an interesting question to ask, because it really is much more of a game that is, the Inferno stuff is sort of a veneer on top of, like, a pretty, you know, like, there'll be levels and then you'll sort of go through them and fight stuff. And so it's an interesting sort of thought experiment. And I think it's also an interesting example where the sort of the way in which these games sort of slightly will borrow from other contexts, but the mechanics of them aren't necessarily sort of inflecting the other kinds of media or content.
Mazoga. Mazoga. Light of my life, fire of my loins. She has the most green skin and the cutest upturned nose. She has a husky, deep voice, sultry and enticing. Her hair is arranged in exquisite black plugs that pepper her otherwise bare skull, those beautiful teeth. She is bold and forthright, never afraid to tussle, and I've personally seen her take a man's life in just a few swings of her two-handed sword. She is a sight to behold, and a knight to boot. I never wanted to be your keeper, Mazoga. I wanted to be your friend, your confidant, your companion. I wanted us to grow together, but now you've become the homebody you never wanted to be.
So My Orcish Wife was actually written in 2006, and I was deep in playing Oblivion, and I was also I had read you know, at that point in time there was sort of this notion of new games journalism, and folks like Chiron Gillian, you know, were doing some really interesting things, and the thing that I took from it was the notion that you should be trying to write sort of travel stories from imaginary lands. And so so as I was playing in Oblivion and being completely obsessed with it, I thought very much about, you know, this quest and this bug in the game, which literally was a glitch in the game. I did eventually resolve it, but that I could never find an interesting way to work that into a coda or anything like that, you know, an epilogue or anything. So I've just kind of ignored that. But it was about 3 months after the fact that I actually ended up being able to resolve that glitch. And it was completely by coincidence. I found Brugo stuck in the middle of a tree and he couldn't move anywhere. And so I just kind of walked up to him and sliced him from behind sneak attack, and he was dead.
The next segment was with David Carlton about his Minecraft blog, and David is, you know, longtime friend of ours. He's a really interesting guy. He's very cool. He's a programmer. You know, he's just a very intelligent guy. Really interested in thinking very deeply about games in ways that I hadn't really considered. And you know, in addition to his Minecraft blog, he also runs a blog where he posts about his progress through Rock Band as he's trying to learn the expert level keyboard, and now he's playing on the real guitar, I think, trying to play through the game. And so he's this piece and David in general have kind of forced me to think about games in these very, very minute, in these very very close up, very zoomed in view of what's happening moment to moment in your gameplay. What I really walked away with from that was this idea of really closely examining your game time in ways that, like I said, are not necessarily immediately apparent.
Been a fan of Christopher Alexander for years and years, but this was the first time when I tried to consciously build something using his ideas. So in his recent works, he talks about the concept of strong centers a lot. And so when I was trying to make a garden on the roof of this building that I was hollowing out, I put a bunch of trees there, and I thought, no, that none of them really stand out very well. So I pruned away all the trees and then put one in the middle. And I thought that was a much, it was, the roof looked much better with one tree than it did with either five trees or with no trees, because it gave a real focus to that part of the roof. One of the things that's I find a little paralyzing when trying to build in Minecraft is that you'll go wandering around along, and then you'll find something that's just stunningly beautiful, you know, some mountain that's stretching up to the sky with a waterfall coursing down it and trees in just the right place. And you think, well, I would never want to build here because there's no way I could improve on that. But fortunately, the whole world isn't that beautiful. And so one of Alexander's points is that you shouldn't just draw up a plan, you know, sitting in your office, and then say this is how buildings should be. Instead, he very much supports placing buildings in the physical context of the space where they're going to be located.
I love that David leverages games develop sort of very real world skills, you know, like the level of thought that he was putting into his Minecraft architecture, you know, is very much akin to the level of thought that I imagine sort of professional architects put into their real world architecture. Another thing that I really like about David is that he's somebody that I became aware of because he listened to our First Wall Rebate. And a lot of people who listen to First Wall Rebate have become people where I read their blogs now, and I really, you know, I became very interested in them. And I think that although I felt like I knew a lot about the world that was out there for sort of, you know, thoughtful takes on gaming and everything, clearly there was a ton that I was missing out on.
So episode 3, it was on the theme of games and education, or educational games. And you started off with the interview with Margie Schmiel, who we had the pleasure of interviewing back in the First of All Rebate days. And she's kind of moved on now and changed careers. She's teaching now, right? And so she was talking about kind of her challenges in terms of attempting to get games into the classroom.
What was interesting, I think, is that Margie was talking about bringing games into the classroom for elementary school kids, which, you know, was fairly different than previously. She was producing games for National Geographic, and we talked about that on First Wall Rebate. She gets into the elementary school classroom, and actually she just recently took a brand new job at Chris Avellone's High School, which is Thomas Jefferson High School, which is one of those, like, nationally famous, it's a science magnet school where super, super brilliant people come from, including some of the first people to ever compete in the Indie Games design contest at GDC and everything. Great, great lineage. And now that she's there, I'm very curious to talk to her in another while about how high school is different and what kind of things she's able to pull off there. Because I'm sure that games are still going to be a factor of what she does.
It's okay for entertainment to be inefficient. We kind of want our entertainment to be inefficient. Sadly, schools don't allow for inefficiency, even though learning is can be and should be a fundamentally inefficient endeavor as well. I mean, you know, a lot of times learning is accidental and serendipitous, and being able to sort of go off on your own or allowing yourself to be unschooled in ways can be incredibly beneficial, and we know that this is the case. You know, and that's why I've always maintained that the problem is that public schools aren't, first and foremost, service to us isn't necessarily always learning, which is incredibly sad. One of the things that we had learned was how to build games that could take a long time to play if you wanted to, but could also get a lot accomplished in a short amount of time, and that's certainly what happened. I'd also done a couple of the energy games with the sixth grade classes, and the other thing that I'd had realized was that teachers were very grateful for having that kind of engaging content in science at the elementary level, because for the most part they don't have the background in it.
I think both in the case of Margie's interview and Dan's interview in that episode, what I really enjoyed about it is they're sort of both talking a lot from the perspective of designers, but designers who really get what the, like, end users and the space in which they're trying to get the things used in is, which is just very different than, there's a lot of educational game stuff that's happened where people are like, oh yeah, people like to learn about things. What if we make a game about X? And then they're like, oh, we'll make it like other games, so it'll be, you know, 7 hours long, and you'll, you know, spend those 7 hours learning about immunology or something like that, right? And it has nothing to do with and they'll say it's a game for ninth graders, and it's like, no, in no universe is there, you know, 7 hours for ninth graders to do stuff with immunology in a science class.
Margie and Dan both hit this very, very distinctly, although from fairly opposite directions, but I think that it's easy for people to believe that, you know, classrooms are sort of just all about learning, and we tend to think of them as either like more like college classrooms, where, you know, there might be a lot of sort of airiness there, or we tend to think of them as more like, you know, sort of sitcom classrooms where, you know, it's kind of these happy joke kind of, you know, things or something like that. And what we forget is that, you know, classrooms are, this is like an educational industry, and you know, contemporary public education in America is very, very, you know, for better and for worse, very sort of industrialized, and it's, you know, it's all about sort of producing these educated members of society who can become participatory in our economic system and be, you know, citizens and everything, and you know, you have, you know, sort of bottom lines to meet in terms of test scores and everything. I mean, that radically you know, shapes what can be done in a way that is really, I mean, not so dissimilar from the mainstream game industry where, you know, games are targeted at like these very tight demographics and released at very specific times of the year because that's what marketing says is the best time of year to release the game. Then we have Mr. Owens, our first contributor, which, frankly, if nothing else, I would be absolutely thrilled just to have a contributor and to be able to actually bring some of the Play the Past content into the podcast. Play the Past is a site that that I think everybody should be reading on a regular basis. I mean, it really brings an angle to games that I think is virtually non-existent in any kind of mainstream gaming, but which, you know, is so utterly relevant because games, it seems to me, are so entwined with perceptions of history, simulations of history, recreations or alterations of history.
In hindsight, the most memorable moments from Fallout 3 are not slow-motion replays of exploding super mutant heads. Most of the in-game moments that have stuck with me involve interactions with Apple II-ish green-screened in-game terminals, computers that have apparently been running since before the nuclear holocaust. For me, playing the game is reconstructing its fictional past. The fictitious history of this world is of critical importance to its players. After nearly 70 hours of gameplay, I never really cared about my character. I didn't really care about her father. I didn't really care much about any of the characters in the game. Instead, I was enthralled with playing the game as a kind of future archaeologist, excavating our present through traces left on these terminals and strewn about the physical landscape. So despite having no history in it, I think Fallout 3 may in fact be the world's best history game. There is no history in Fallout 3, more specifically, the idea of history as what happened in the past is nowhere to be found in the game. However, it's the best game I've played at getting at historical thinking. The story behind that piece is that I had played way too much Fallout, and I just... Whatever I play, I sort of end up putting in this history lens. And I really wanted to put more stuff, get more posts on the blog that weren't just me writing about sort of like civilization and colonization, like all of these history sim games, which are sort of like what people expect when you say you're interested in history and games. What I really enjoyed was it's probably the original piece of writing that I did for this is probably the most read of anything I've written, which is just a really sort of weird thing to note.
Kind of took stock of the situation. I said, what are you going to do? You have like 300 pinball machines. In the 15 years of my collecting, I basically had come to realize that there was very little written literature or history that was documented about pinball. There were a few books, but there really were not a lot of stuff. So I started researching and going to conferences and meeting some of the people who were part of the pinball lore, you know, that had been manufacturers, who had been workers there, etc. So when I decided to take stock of this situation, I said, I think pinball really needs a museum. No, actually, this year is the 140th anniversary of the plunger on a pinball game, and so all of this information was out there in different forms, and I felt it was really a necessity to put this together.
really, really enjoyed the episode on the National Pinball Museum. Somewhere that I'm never going to get a chance to go, apparently.
You know, they might... He actually gave me some inside knowledge about some of the places that they're looking at moving. And as it turns out, the new sort of land management, property management company has actually... after kind of realizing what they did, sort of stomping on them so hard, has been a lot friendlier to work with. And so they got the extension, and I think it's still too early to kind of count on some of the things that he was saying might happen. But I certainly have very high hopes that the National Pinball Museum doesn't go away. It's a phenomenal collection of games, I got to say. I mean, and the cool thing is that almost every single thing there is playable, and so it is a hands-on kind of museum. And I think they do a good job of walking the boundary between sort of informative museum and arcade. David Silverman sort of spoke about that he doesn't he knows that an arcade isn't something that can last forever. Museums are different kinds of things. The Nick Hagman interview really was just a wonderful thing to end the season on. You can feel both, the joy of gaming there. Clearly, it's something that he does because he enjoys it, and he enjoys gaming. But it's not just about the game; it's about sort of the community surrounding the playing of the game. And I think for a lot of us, that's a big part of why we play. Playing the game can be difficult and tedious and take forever, but then the payoff for having played it becomes the thing that you're really after.
Ever since I beat Castlevania 1 on a dance pad, I saw people requesting Ninja Gaiden, and I saw that and I just laughed like, no way, I'm never going to beat that game. That's absurd. People getting fed up like, where's Ninja Gaiden? I want to see Ninja Gaiden. It was really, really frustrating. It took me 8 months to beat that game. There was no motivation to beat the game except for the cry from my fans.
I think you're right to highlight that it's, this is a hard way to play these games. But at the same time, it's a really sort of playful act to be like, wow, what if you did that on the dance pad? It's sort of like,
yeah.
It's this really, it's just sort of like, sort of a gee whiz kind of thing. It's really neat.
Colonization. I can't believe the guts that it must take to sort of put it out there that a story of colonization without recognition of triangular trade is not a story of the colonization of North America.
Native peoples and Europeans are not even algorithmically the same kinds of people. Native peoples are unable to establish new cities. They simply wait for Europeans to take advantage of them and trade or obliterate and loot their civilization. In short, the code itself for colonization is racist and offensive. But wouldn't and shouldn't any game about that period in the Americas be racist and offensive, if it was even to be remotely faithful to that time period? Colonization is problematic. But the mechanics of the game offer players the opportunity to think about the game's model of history, conquest, and exploitation. There's sort of a knee-jerk critical response to games, which is like, how could you make a game about something offensive? And then the other response that's like, no, it's complicated and it's interesting. And I'm much more, the thing that I feel good about in this piece is that, and what I'd like to see more sort of sort of games criticism attempt to do is that it's not really, I'm not trying to criticize, you know, the people who made the game. I'm not saying like, oh, I wish there were more X or less Y or they should have done it this way. I really think the game is very well done in the constraints of what our culture will let a game do. And so in some ways it's sort of like cultural criticism as opposed to criticizing, you know, design decisions that were made. If you go back and watch a movie like The Patriot, like, of course Mel Gibson was really great to the slaves he had and he was going to free them and all these, like, it's just not actually a part of American history that in any medium we're generally very comfortable with putting out in sort of a mass way and really dealing with.
We hope you enjoyed this special edition of Playable Character. Our music in this episode is In Order by Grapes, Dave Logan, and DJ Funkin' Wackles. We've noticed that some of you have taken the time to pass links to the show around on forums and Reddit and so forth, and we really, really appreciate that. And on top of that, we'd love to hear from you. You can always get in touch with us through Twitter at PlayableCHAR, Facebook at facebook.com/PlayableCharacter, and through email at info@playablecharacter.com. I want to make sure to thank all of you for listening through our first season. And as I said in the beginning of the show, we will return with all new episodes on Thursday, October 6th. But in the meantime, be sure to stay tuned because we will have some extra content for you to fill the gap. So until then, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.